Hi, and welcome to Loops, a podcast brought to you by Caribou Projects. We're an arts collective based in Bristol, and each episode we collaborate with a guest artist, cultivating conversations around social histories, folklore, visual arts, music, and everything else that falls between the cracks. In this episode, we'll be talking about cassette tapes.
Kila marku dararaya hai lavani duktaye lavani duktaye lavani dukta.
My name's Fozia Ismail. I run a Somali supper club called Arawello Eats, which is also a research platform for thinking about identity. I'm also one third of a Somali art collective called Dagan Collective. Camel Meat and Tapes was an interdisciplinary and intergenerational project working with Somali elders looking at the use of tape letters in the Somali community during migration. We spoke to a range of people for this episode to get different perspective on diasporic tape cultures, the practice of recording onto tape, preservation, as well as destruction. Ibrahim Hersey is a poet and archivist and co-founder of Waberi Phone, which practices an integrative, archival-based approach in the preservation, revival, and development of Somali art and culture. Asma Jama is a Danish-born Somali poet and artist, and is also one-third of the Dagan Collective. We also spoke to Wajid Yassin, a Manchester-born, London-based artist, whose work draws on an interdisciplinary approach to develop sound-based works encompassing installations, live performances, acousmatic music, graphic scores, and sound sculptures. He's the director of the Sound Art Research Cooperative, Modus Arts, who are currently working on Tape Letters, an oral history project aiming to identify, collect, and archive messages sent on cassette tape in the 1960s through to the 1980s by families who migrated to the UK from Pakistan between 1950 and 1970. Finally, we spoke to Heinbeck, a Berlin-based electronic music composer and performer who uses modular synths, tape, and test equipment to create experimental music. Through his YouTube channel, Heinbach brings experimental music techniques to a wider audience. We spoke to Heinbach about his love of working with tape, the physicality of the medium, and the unique sound that tape recordings have.
My name's Ibrahim Hersey. I'm a student, a digital archivist, and a peer researcher with the Centre for Mental Health. The first way I was exposed to the cassette tape was in a religious context. So the Quran was really recorded a lot on cassette tapes. And my dad and my mum used to have hundreds of these of the Quran with different reciters. And that was the way I was raised, in a kind of, you know, very, you know, Quran-like filled household. So automatically the cassette tape, you know, extremely nostalgic. And then as I grow older and I'm trying to connect more with my culture and learn more about, you know, Somali literature and music, my dad says he has this small cachet of like cassette tapes.
Hi, I'm Asma Jama. I'm a poet and visual artist based in Bristol. I mean, I guess I was fascinated that Somali people would use cassette tapes as a medium. I mean, my experience of them has really been cassettes that have had Quran on them or Islamic lectures. And it turns out, when I asked my parents later, that they were actually, I think originally, cassettes that people had recorded on and then they'd recorded over it. And then after Fozia told me about the project, I went to America and I met my uncle, and he said that he'd had these cassettes and he'd actually digitized them.
And I didn't even know that these survived the war. Like, I had no idea. Like, I didn't know like there was that many of these available out there. So, you know, I was over the moon. And because of my previous like relationship with them, I just felt so comfortable around this medium.
I I mean, he got quite emotional because Cassette still, they had the voices of his family members that had passed on. And he was pretty on board with giving them to me. And I thought it was interesting that he chosen to preserve that. I think for him, it was the last remnant of home that he had because he left at quite a young age.
I think even back then, I was quite aware of the emotional attachment people had to these cassette tapes. I always tried to be wary of coming into spaces and saying to people, I've got this hobby, you have to give me the cassette tapes for me to perform. I didn't want to ever be like that because I knew that for a lot of these people, it might be one of the few links they've got back home. You know, there's a lot of emotional attachment to it, basically.
In the end, I decided not to like push him on or really remind him to give me access to that because I guess he was really concerned that my mom would accidentally come across it.
So what I would do is, like, with my family, it's a lot easier, especially my immediate family. I mean, my dad doesn't really listen to music like that anymore. So he just said to me, take them. And I said, okay. So I would take these and then I would digitize them. I bought this little really basic rubbish setup, but then I would digitize them. And then it became a question of, I've got what, like 6 or 7? And I want to get more, so how do I get more? So I would say to some family members that were extended, you know, please let me borrow these. I will record them, I will digitize them, and then I'll give them to you. And I'll also give you the other ones that I've digitized, that kind of thing. So I always wanted them to feel like, this is yours. I'm just going to literally like make a copy of it. I'm gonna bring it right back, same condition and that. And also with some people, I might not have even asked because I thought you get a vibe of people, right? So people knew about the project, but you could feel like maybe they might stiffen a bit or whatever. So I understood kind of, I'm not gonna ask them for this because they're not gonna feel comfortable with it.
I think I was just fascinated by like what it is to record your voice onto something that lasts after you've gone. And I know that like cassette tapes are like very like ephemeral, so I don't know, perhaps not the best thing to use.
I think the main reason it was recorded is A, it's like cheap in terms of, you know, to produce. For example, there used to be these things called silsilas, which are like chains of poetry, right? So one person would say a poem and about a serious topic and issue that has, you know, taken place, and another person would reply, and another person would reply, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So what you have is, in that context, you have this cassette tape, which is easy to produce and reproduce. So you don't really have to be rich to make the poem, right? And to reproduce so that people can share it amongst each other, it's also cheap. And then you've got this thing where it's small, so you're able to carry everywhere. I mean, when the cassette tape was brought, it revolutionized these silsilas because more people could engage, because you have this small, like, little piece of plastic that can reach from, you know, the Arabian Peninsula to, you know, Djibouti to Somalia to Ethiopia to everywhere. So wherever Somalis live, these cassettes would find themselves in a nomadic context. Everything needs to be able to have like multiple functions, or it needs to earn its place. That's why they don't really carry drums, because it's extra weight. I mean, you might hear it here and there. Instead, they'll use a motor and they'll put like a sheepskin or something on top of it and bang that as a drum. And it's actually louder than like the drums that they might use in the cities. But everything needs to have that, you know, it needs to earn its place.
Well, I guess it's not just like cassette tapes that are being sent, it's camel meat. And, you know, that's still sent across the border. My parents are like very, not the whole community really, is very clued up on how to send things abroad. What's the best packing service to use? So like recently I sent something to my friend in South Africa and it's like lost in the post. And then my parents were like, oh, you should have just used DHL. Shouldn't have used Royal Mail. I'm like, I didn't know that you knew about that, but they do. Yeah, and then also, like, anytime someone's flying to Kenya, because my grandma lives there, there's always, like, a phone around to, like, anyone that has family in Kenya. And then they're like, is there anything that you want me to, like, take with me? And I just feel like community is sort of existing across, like, borders that are a lot more porous than we think they are, maybe, is interesting. I just think the world is like way more expansive and way more interconnected than the people in power at the moment would like to admit.
Oh, Hi, my name is Wajid Yassin. I'm a Manchester-born, London-based sound artist. Sort of originally started as a music producer 20-odd years ago. Sort of infamous in the industrial noise scene. Sort of experimental sort of music thing. And then I sort of shifted into sonic arts practice and set up Modest Arts, which I'm the director of, about 10 years ago. And we're sort of interested in interdisciplinary sonic arts practice. The project came about from a visit I paid to my mum's home in Manchester about 5 years ago, actually. And it was on the back of me wanting to revisit my dad's voice. One of the things that he used to do was to sing knots, and knots are a kind of a devotional hymn, right? And he was asked to sing knots in people's homes, in mosques and wherever, you know, and it got to the point where people were asking him to record these knots on cassette tape. And I found some of these cassettes, and it was lovely to sort of, you know, to obviously revisit the knots themselves. But alongside these cassettes, you know, my mum's sort of drawer in her bedroom were these other cassettes. And when I had, you know, I had these cassettes in my hand, I was like, I remember this. I remember being pulled into doing this when I was a kid. And I'm having to sort of say, you know, say hello to some auntie or uncle in Pakistan, like really reluctantly. And all the kind of memories that I had of that as a boy, and growing up in Manchester, it sort of just came back to me in that one moment. And I kind of realized when I had this cassette in my hand, I had something pretty special, you know. I kind of essentially was holding a sort of historical artifact, really, a piece of kind of British heritage, actually, which is what I've now come to realize is quite an important one. In some weird way, in that moment, you know, like ideas sort of hit you really hard sometimes, you know, and I kind of suddenly realized I had something pretty important on my hands, you know, right there and then, you know. And I kind of knew that actually if our family did this, it couldn't have been just us lot, you know. And so I sort of went on a bit of a hunt to find more of them. And yeah, I found loads. I mean, the tape letters themselves, they contain, for one thing, very private messages, right? So they contain things like land disputes. I'll just give you an example of one of the stories that sort of that we've touched on recently, right? What happened in this case was he came over to the UK with his sister when he was 12. And his father then had to go back to Pakistan. So essentially, him and his sister grew up with their uncle here in the UK. And so they were essentially parentless. And his dad used cassette tapes as a way of bringing this guy up remotely. All of this guy's moral code was informed by kind of what was going on in the tapes themselves, right? So, the, you know, the guy was like, yeah, this is how you should study. This is how you should be behaving in British society, all of that, right? And he'd be scolding him for this and that, whatever. And he basically built up the relationship that the cassettes were his dad. That was the only way that he could access his dad through these things. So his dad passed away. And essentially these cassettes are the ashes. They're the sonic ashes of his dad. Right, he's given these to us. And in his interview, he said something like, you know, when you've got an imaginary friend, right? And everyone kind of knows about that. As a kid, you have an imaginary friend. As a kid, my imaginary friend was my dad. That's devastating. That's an extraordinary thing, right? They contain things like recipes. You know, actually, we found out in one instance, there's a restaurateur in Bradford who set up his business on the back of the recipes that were sent to him by his dad in Pakistan. We've had couples that were arranged to be married because that was kind of one of the traditional ways for people to get married, obviously. And they couldn't actually use phones because it wasn't very private for them. So they used these public call offices and they weren't private enough either. So they used these cassette tapes between each other. They sent cassette tapes to each other for every 2 weeks for 3 years. And so they've got 60 each, and they essentially fell in love over the tapes, right? And you know, so sometimes, you know, when you fall in love, it's kind of, it hits you hard and hits you straight away. Whereas for them, it's flowered over time, you know? And so it's really amazing for that to actually be, you know, to manifest on the tapes, right? So you've got all of that, you know? And then you've got kind of the usual domestic stuff of like, we're having to sort of trudge through snow to get to the laundrette. And you're hearing the voice of mum's crying. I mean, like, there's all sorts of extraordinary sort of capture of what it was like to be a migrant, right? But also people like me, who the product of migration, the children of migration, and kind of essentially how they're roped in to sort of to deal with these messages at the time, you know? So they're pretty significant in terms of like a sort of a sonographic snapshot of the time, you know? We stumbled on all sorts of, you know, sort of ethical issues with regards to, you know, so what we'd make public, given the private nature of these things. But the cassettes themselves, they weren't always intended for one-to-one listening. There was a lot of sort of group listening, right? So there'd be sort of groups within, like familial groups, like family groups. There'd be like, if they were being sent to Pakistan, there'd be sort of neighbor groups as well, you know? So we've got all of that. We've got, in some instances, we had, you know, sexually explicit conversations that were going on there. One of the cassettes was so explosive in terms of the content and has the implication to cause damage to like numbers of families to this day. The only way that it would be included in the archive and be accepted in the archive and given to us was if we wrote up a specific contract, which we did, and it's basically part of the closed, it's closed access at the Bishopsgate, and nobody can access it for 50 years, right? So that's an interesting anomaly for us. And that particular cassette, it just hits every ethical red line, right?
Hi, I'm Heinbach. I'm an electronic musician and composer from Berlin. And I've got a YouTube channel where I talk about experimental music techniques and weird gear. And for example, tape. I started out with tape, I think when I was 8, because that was the main recording medium that was there. So with friends, I redubbed old cowboy audio plays. So that idea went nowhere after the first like 5 minutes, as we discovered how much work it is to put on an audio play. So I stopped using tape as my main medium to record until I was 15 and was in a band, and tape was just the only thing we had to get any kind of recording. And usually it was the same recorder that we used to record these Western plays, just put in a corner. And that was the sound and all that we had. And I quickly started to experiment because the band felt kind of limiting to me. So I started to experiment with recording onto tape, like recording to the left side and then dubbing that onto the right side and putting in radio feedback, playing piano with one hand while manipulating an FM radio and creating soundscapes, ambient soundscapes that way. I've been destroying and working with tape for quite some time. Like, I love to do all kinds of manipulations with that. For example, destruction loops, where I take tape loops and record something on them. Maybe it's something that I want to be exercised, like hateful comments on my channel and other people's channels. So I recorded those, put knives to that, and over time, the magnetic dust that kept the information was scraped from the plastic that keeps the magnetic dust together. And the mean comments just faded. All the racism, the nationalism, the simple meanness and hate just passed on into noise and which was very cathartic. I kept around like tapes when I was walking around, going out. I kept like one or two tapes like in a pocket. And then if I found someone like, I don't know, it could be interesting just to give it to that person. I gave them that cassette and maybe a DJ and they would play it. It's a bit like, yeah, same with vinyl. If you have like vinyl of your record and you're hanging out in a record store and there's a DJ come on and give it to them and you hear it next day, you hear it like in a show or something. It's so direct. It's just something very, very human in the end. You just pass on this data that is recorded and people can just plug it in and there's no like entering a complex download code, scanning stuff on your phone.
Maybe this is kind of like a conversation that's been had about digital and analog spaces, right? you know, and like what it means to sort of have a Zoom meeting than what that feels like to sort of to meet somebody in person, right? And the kind of slightly disembodied thing about digital experiences. I think the tapes just represent something analog, right? It has a physical presence in the space and all of that. You know, it's all surrounded by tactileness, right? We respond to the physics of objects in space. So I think in one thing, that's what they may represent to people.
A long time before the cassette came around, there was open reels. And that's technology that was developed, yeah, mostly in Germany, and then got spread around the world thanks to it being pretty good and Bing Crosby wanting to record his sessions in the best possible way. And back in the day, the best possible way was direct to vinyl, and that wasn't really the good quality or didn't give you the length that you needed. You had to take a lot of breaks. And then from the war, a friend of his brought like these German magnetic tape machines. He was like, oh, this is interesting. So he started investing in this company that was building this and was called Ampex. And Ampex became one of the main tape machine and tape makers of the world. So these open reels, they had a fantastic sound, but they were open reels. So it could easily happen that you would just spill all this beautiful tape all across the room if you weren't careful. It wasn't user-friendly. So ever since tape was around, there were many, many attempts to make it more user-friendly. And cassette was the one that became the most successful.
Cassette tapes were clearly used in different modes, right? So they were originally developed in 1963 by Philips, and it was made essentially as a music media. So it was a kind of a distribution thing, right? So they just made, for the most part, they were kind of for pretty much distributing pre-recorded music. And of course, what's happened to them is what is interesting for me, which is kind of when people start reappropriating like technology, right? So they're kind of using it for something else.
I still think it's very futuristic that you had like camel herders also recording with cassettes. So I don't know, I think it feels very Afrofuturistic looking at like other ways that we have like indigenous technologies that aren't just tech. Because a lot of people have been making sourdough over lockdown, and so have I. And then my mum was like, you're not doing anything interesting or new. This is what we used to do all of the time.
Yeah, we had that also with like clicks and cuts, for example, like when the era of the CD skipping becomes the sound of the music. There was like a movement of artists using the clicks and cuts, all the sound of errors of audio editing and all that stuff that you don't want, and made that the feature. So that became the snare drum, that became the hi-hat, and that became like a huge influence on minimal techno. So all these eras of media are interesting. And the medium is always the thing, like from the manufacturer's point of view, it always tries to be the best representation of the sound that you get. But it's the artists that explore the point where it breaks.
Cassette tapes and records, you know, they have the kind of their use right now. You know, you've got that kind of, yeah, we're going to use retro tech to listen to music that we just bloody stream now, right? But there is a particular pleasure in listening to records and listening to tapes. But, you know, I mean, they are inconvenient too.
And nowadays, I think tape is perfect in its quality for stuff like ambient music, something. I mean, my kids still listen to tapes when they fall asleep. So I've got this old recorders that playback devices from schools that sound just great compared to anything modern. And they listen to old plays that I used to listen to when I was a kid. And just the noisy quality and the constant just adds to the very calming feeling.
So Wabedifone is an organization, and we've got two parts. So number one is we want to educate Somalis, younger Somalis, diaspora Somalis, about their culture, their literature, their language. When I was starting out, I found it extremely difficult to learn anything. It took me like a few months just to find books. Like, it was really difficult for me to just find these things. So we want to make it easier for people to do this. So that's one of the reasons why we've got the page, but we also want to do more other stuff in terms of educating the community, being out in the community, working with the community. That's one aspect of it. You know, we always need to give back to the community. And then the second aspect is Wavery Records, which re-releases old songs. So by this, our intentions are twofold. We want to A, give ownership back to the artist. A lot of these artists have constantly been exploited by Somalis and non-Somalis alike. So we want to give them ownership of their music, and we also want to get that music on a wider platform so that younger Somalis can connect with it. You know, we really want younger diaspora Somalis to connect with the culture, to find home in the culture.
There seems to be like a real hunger for art and cultural work around Somalia and the Somali diaspora. And so like we had people engaging across the world, really, and I feel like that's not unique to our project. It's more just like with lots of Somali creative projects, is that it's speaking to like Canadian Somalis, Somalis in Kenya, Australian Somalis, and so on. And I feel like that's coming from like the fact that people want to reconnect with their heritage, understand themselves in a way where it's not just through this very colonial lens or what you're taught in institutions. And so a lot of the projects that I've seen have kind of worked around archiving, understanding like what a nation is and how like Somali nationhood is like a myth. Yeah, and I guess like also a lot of looking back to the past, but with a critical lens and looking at the role of women. But also at the same time, I feel like there's still this consuming of art and cultural work without really appreciating cultural workers. But I think that's just like across all of society, where it's like, I don't really think Somali artists are valued in the community, but I don't think any artists are valued in any community, really. It's like their work is appreciated and it's seen as useful, but I feel like it's kind of rare for them to be seen as valuable.
One of the contracts that we gave to one of the artists, we had several people look over it and people were like, I think that's a bit weird. So we said, we'll take that in and we're not going to say no, because if you think it's weird, then we're going to speak to the artist about it. And we're like, maybe that is weird because we're new to this. So then we change it. Like, it's as simple as that. And we try and do that with everything, and we want to work just in whatever capacity we can to support the community. So everything we do, like in the way that the mota in traditional nomadic society has, like, you know, multiple functions, we want everything we do to have multiple functions and each one of them to be supporting the community. In terms of crate digging, and we see this culture of what people have aptly named culture vultures, these culture vultures who will come into the community, take what they feel they have a right to, reproduce it, share it amongst their own communities, and not give anything back. I think even earlier, I just spoke about how I was scared of even asking my relatives of these cassette tapes. I always came with that kind of thing where this is so important to a group of people. How can I come and take what is not mine, right? The thing is, though, if you're coming into a community who has been mistreated and they've received the short end of the stick so many times, there's been a lot of malpractice in the community, you need to come in with the kind of thing where, if this doesn't even belong to me, this is not even my culture, but what I might be able to do is, and what might make up for that, is that I'm going to come in, I'm going to build something for these people. I might build like a building where they can store these cases, or I might fund lessons so youngers can learn music and so that the culture can develop. I might do like just a bunch of measures, right? So that can help the community. And I'm also going to give extremely favorable terms to these musicians because it's their life's work. So they deserve to get as much as possible, right? But that attitude is not held. The attitude that is held is, I am doing something for these people because I'm going to show this music to a wider audience. And what they tend to do is, these culture watches, they conflate that with discovering it. I have discovered this music. You haven't discovered anything, mate. There's a rich musical tradition in this country for a ridiculously long time. And a lot of these people, they work in really bad ways. They'll lie about their intentions to people in the community so they can get close to artists. They do a lot of questionable things. And you can just see that when you see all of these little things they're doing, you understand that this is not a pure project. This is not for the community. This is not going to benefit the community. We just look at the fact that in the end, the Somali community is contributing to like the wider world story in terms of where we're gifting you this culture, this music. A lot of these songs, their melodies, I mean, the roots of it, the poetic forms have been around for hundreds of years, thousands of years even. So we are giving you an integral piece of ourselves, you know, the thread of our poetics, our literature, our art.
Two people that we interviewed on the pilot project have since passed away, and their families were like unbelievably grateful to have us have interviewed them, you know, and that we could just pass on this audio to them and say, look, here's your mum's voice, here's your dad's voice, right? And of course, we, as you know, people who dropped in to sort of interview these people, can ask them questions that their children wouldn't have been able to do, right?
I think there seems to be like a reluctance to talk about the war and the events surrounding it. I think there was only really like one time where I actually, you know, sat down with my mom and asked her outright, and that was for a project. But then I regretted doing that because it wasn't, I think it kind of, I think she chose to take herself back to and remember some very painful histories for me, and I didn't think that was a good method of approaching it, especially when like I hadn't planned for any aftercare or anything afterwards. And I think a lot of people have just, you know, moved on with their lives. And I think those cassette tapes, like for example with my dad, like he got a cassette tape from his uncle telling him to live a good life and take care of himself, kind of like advice or like weni or not dardarum, but like sort of similar, like you give advice to somebody that's far away from you. I think it was just perhaps too painful. I don't think anyone really wanted to revisit that. Like even when we were working with the elders, we didn't bring up the war and they didn't bring up the war. And when they were talking about migration, they kind of spoke around it, you know? It was just like, we all, like, fled and then we came to this country. And there's no real revisiting. And I think even, like, with my conception of what happened during the war, it's very murky. It's completely, it's all in fragments. And, you know, there'll be, like, I might just be randomly working sometimes and my mum will come in and, like, tell me a story out of nowhere, and I don't really know where it fits.
So that thing about sort of essentially capturing some of their feelings, some of these people's ideas about, you know, before they pass away, is a great thing, you know. And I mean, the fact that I can revisit my dad's singing is lovely, but I bloody wish I had interviewed him in the way that I've interviewed my mum. And for sure, all of this kind of wisdom and knowledge and information, it's all bound into these guys, you know, so we want to sort of tease it out.
From the preservation of voices in the form of sonic ashes of loved ones held in tape, to the creative use of destructive loops to cathartically drown out hate, the emotional value and attachment of this particular medium of cassette tapes speaks to the significance of analogue technology and what it means to us in a digital age. Cassette tapes are an artifact that, as Wajid beautifully describes, capture a sonographic snapshot of time. Through the conversations that I've had with these wonderful artists, it's really helped me think through the next steps of Camel Meat and Tapes. I really want to work through some of the emotional weight of archiving by creating something new, and that's something that we did with the Dagan Collective Soundscape. One of the things I've learned through making this podcast is the way in which tapes have always been an accessible medium of exchanging parts of ourselves with others, and that this helps us make sense of some of the complex realities of our worlds. Thanks for listening. And if you want to find out more information about cassette letters and our contributors, you can head to our website. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to be notified about future episodes, then subscribe on your platform. Thank you.